Hello, everyone, and welcome to the End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Vince Masson.
Still recovering from the break, I see.
Oh, do you see? Okay,
I'm trying. He's sort of laid back. It's like, you know, we had almost too much time off.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, probably. Yeah. I'm sorry if I'm giving that effect. I'll try to go a little more intense.
Thank you.
I noticed you're wearing a Star Wars in Concert shirt. Now, what was that event about?
It's pretty much what it sounded like. It's Star Wars music in concert hosted by Anthony Daniels.
Interesting. Okay. I've never heard of it. I'm sorry.
This was in 2010.
Okay. All right.
So the shirt's been around for a while.
All right.
Let's get into the show. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We are here every Wednesday at 2 to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the accidental superhero franchise film, Glass. And that's in the second half of the show. For the first half of the show, we're going to talk about some of the movie news from the past week, including the Fyre Festival. There are two new documentaries on the subject, but do they tell us anything new about the greatest party that never happened? And then we'll talk about the British film classification changes to rate movies with sexual violence more harshly, and is that a wise move? And then finally, we will take a look back at the career of M. Night Shyamalan so far and how he's managed to have one of the few movie comebacks in modern history, and whether or not he's about to blow it all again. And that'll lead us into the second half of the show. No spoilers. But first, surprise! New Year's surprise! There's a new Ghostbusters movie in development.
There is.
More surprising to some. It was announced last week that Jason Reitman is co-writing and directing a new Ghostbusters movie that'll be in theaters in the summer of 2020. He is co-writing it with Gil Keenan, who not well known, but if you've seen Monster House or City of Ember or the Poltergeist remake, those are all his. And so this is going to be set in, shall we say, the prime Ghostbusters universe, as in, you know, with the going back to the 1984 film, apropos since Jason Reitman is the son of Ivan Reitman, who directed the first two Ghostbusters movies, and then they released a teaser trailer and everything.
Yeah, except the teaser trailer was just what, fog and then the car?
Yeah.
Right.
The car is in a barn-like structure, but it uses, and it's covered in tarp, and then you see the wind blow, and the wind blows the tarp up, and you hear the Ghostbusters music.
Yeah, all right.
There was a little bit more to it.
Okay, sorry. I omitted the tarp, my bad.
It would have been funny if it just been a black screen and says, Ghostbusters 2020. See ya, nerds, or something like that. It would have been.
Yeah, but at the same time, it's like, what does that little teaser tell you about the movie at all? Like, nothing.
No. Was it supposed to?
Well, I thought, teasers should do that, you know? And video games do this, too. They're always a teaser, and then they just show you, I don't know, the most, bare bones thing ever. You can't get a sense of the movie.
Well, I gather they're trying to build up hype because, for whatever reason, although I think we know the reason, that the 2016 Paul Feig Ghostbusters is not looked at terribly fondly by a very loud subset of fandom. So they're trying to get positive buzz going. And I mean, that the teaser was all about serving that nostalgia. You know, it uses the original Elmer Bernstein music, which is great. I like that music a lot. But, you know, it was all about sort of serving that audience, serving that need. That's now we're going back to basics. None of these chick Ghostbusters. I almost said chick Transformers for some reason. But none of these girls.
Yeah, what girl movies Ghostbusters. Have you been pondering?
Well, I did watch Bumblebee over the break.
Okay. some skeletons in your closet, maybe?
Maybe.
I don't know.
Who knows?
Why do we need this Ghostbusters, honestly? Why
I don't know.
Should we care?
I don't know. I would be fine without it.
Yeah. So why can't we make the segment about that? Why can't we
Well, make the segment about it.
Okay. Why can't we think of new original ideas. How about that? How about scrap the Ghostbusters and just come up with something new?
The fascinating thing is that, like, Ghostbusters, the original, was this sort of accidental hit that, you know, it was Dan Aykroyd's idea, but because Dan Aykroyd is, like, so steeped in, like, the unsolved mysteries and sci-factor, you know, the things, that it was, like, a very esoteric script. So Harold Ramis comes in and starts, like, throwing all the paranormal BS out of it, makes it more of a comedy. And then, like, John Belushi was originally supposed to be in it, and then he dies, so they bring in Bill Murray. And, you know,
it was a combination of time and place,
right,
and people.
Because even if you go back to when they were producing Ghostbusters 2, it was like they pretty much had to get everyone in a room and sort of lock the door and say, you're not coming out until you get Ghostbusters 2. And, like, it was a rush production. It was like 6 or 8 months. And so at the end of it, you get
is
something
that the one with Moranis, Rick Moranis?
Well, Rick Moranis is in both of them.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
No, the Ghostbusters 2 is
my Ghostbusters.
Ghostbusters
history.
2 is the one with the painting. The painting that's
okay. Right.
They go the Carpathian.
but what I'm trying to say is, it sounds like they're trying to replicate something that you can no longer replicate. And instead of trying to do that, why not come up with your own Ghostbusters-esque or inspired thing instead of just trying to remake what is already arguably perfect? Not perfect, but perfect enough.
I mean, it's sort of the time, right? That...
And then what does that say about the 2016 one?
Right.
Like, are they trying, is this an effort to, like, make everyone forget about that one, or?
Well, that's a good question, because I'm not one of these people who, I actually enjoyed it.
The 2016
one. I enjoyed it. Yeah. It's not like a perfect movie. It has its issues. And I think one of the issues was, like, it was too referential back to the original. They had to cram absolutely everybody in for a cameo. And sometimes those cameos sucked, like Dan Aykroyd's cameo, actually, in that movie. But I wrote the review for Ghostbusters for Nerd Bastards, which was a website I was writing for a while. And... when the review went up, there are these people who posted on the Facebook feed for Nerd Bastards that's like, oh, you're a Sony shill and you're a hack and you're like this and that. And it's like...
You're a what?
A shill.
Okay.
But the inference was that Sony paid me for a positive... As it was for, like, any critic who gave the film a positive review. It has, like, 75% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Right.
So that was a lot of money that Sony threw around to people like me. But...
Yeah, clearly.
I'm living large in a 10-year-old t-shirt.
How did you really afford Star Wars in concert? Sony was pulling some strings behind the scenes.
No, it's right. So it's, and when I see reactions like that, it almost makes me even more sympathetic to the movie.
Right.
Because it's just like, why are you piling on? It's just this silly little Ghostbusters movie.
But wasn't it also, like, supposed to be some kind of political statement as well? It's like, now we have the all-female Ghostbusters, and now it seems like they're just steamrolling over that, like, 2 years later.
I don't know how political it was. I think it was just sort of a way to rejigger it and shake things up, because one of the things that was holding it...
Yeah, maybe political is the wrong word, but...
Well, one of the things that was holding up Ghostbusters 3 for years, because, of course, Dan Aykroyd has been pushing Ghostbusters 3 since the credits rolled on Ghostbusters 2. One of the things that's been holding that up is Bill Murray. Bill Murray is, like, sometimes he's maybe in, sometimes he's definitely out.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the times he's definitely out. And you can't depend on Bill Murray.
Is he coming back for this newest one then?
No, but, well, that's a good question, because apparently from what sources have said, it's a new cast. It's another new cast. It's going to be like sort of Teen Ghost Hunters kind of thing.
But Bill Murray may presumably have a large cameo or supporting role or something.
Well, keep in mind, Bill Murray is the guy who did Garfield, because he mistook Ethan Coen Ethan Coen's name on the script for Ethan Coen.
No way.
Yes. He very famously told this story. So, I mean, in the interest of like maybe working with someone as talented as Jason Reitman, maybe you can entice Bill Murray back. Maybe Dan Aykroyd just didn't have enough cachet with Bill Murray to drag him back for a number three. I mean, who knows? But I think...
That's the key, eh? I need to like just... do Steven Spielberg and then change just like some
Spielberg.
Yes. Yeah.
And he'll just gloss over it. And yeah. Just like, oh, Spielberg.
Finally. Bill, I got the script for you, man. Don't worry about the Borg. It was a typo.
It was a typo. No, Spielberg will totally be here. Spielborg. But yeah.
So who's directing this?
Jason Reitman.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Right. So, I mean. It's that's not even like it really in his wheelhouse. Like he hasn't done anything even remotely like Ghostbusters.
And that's people were saying he was getting back in his wheelhouse for was it the Front Runner with Hugh Jackman?
Yeah.
So I assume his wheelhouse is those kind of troubled men like drama films.
Character driven movies like Tully and Juno and Thank You for Smoking and Young Adult, and it's...
So this might be an effort just to, like, please his dad or something.
Or, yeah, or an effort to become more commercial, and then maybe I mean, he has... I don't think he's had a hit, like, a genuine hit since Juno.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there's all of that at play.
Up in the Air, wasn't that a...
Up in the Air, yeah. Up in the Air was a big hit, too, actually. What wasn't a hit was the Fyre Festival. And
true.
You may have heard about this almost 2 years ago. It was this big thing in the Bahamas, and Blink 182 and Major Lazer were headlining this concert, and it was supposed to be this big destination experience, like Hillside, but for people who make like $250,000 or more a year. But it was an utter and complete failure. But nothing's ever really a failure in Hollywood, because you can always like do two different documentaries. There is Fyre, the greatest party that never happened,
which is now on Netflix.
And there is Fyre Fraud.
You and I saw that film.
Yes. Right. And the other one is Fyre Fraud, which is on Hulu, which is sadly unavailable in Canada. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting the the background of these. But what did you think of Fyre, the greatest party that never happened?
I thought it was a fascinating documentary, honestly. Like, I honestly, for some reason, I can't get enough of this story. And I think it all comes down to this character, this Billy McFarland guy, mm-hmm. who was kind of behind all of it. Like, they were kind of advertising it as a Ja Rule, Billy McFarland kind of co-production. Mm-hmm. It's like both of them were going to put on this massive, the biggest concert the world has ever seen in the Bahamas. But this guy, Billy McFarland, was really kind of, it seems like he was kind of sociopathic in the way that he's able to get money from people.
Yeah,
because he sunk millions and millions. He now, of course, got convicted of like misleading all of these people. He's in prison. But he is the kind of character that like, Hollywood movies are made out of, man. This guy, this like Jerry Lundegaard-esque guy who knows he's like in the weeds, but still keeps like piling it on. You know what I mean? Just gets further and further into debt to reach this goal that quite frankly is kind of silly. Anyway,
he's Jerry Lundegaard on steroids. Yeah,
yeah. It was at the point where he knew like that he couldn't pull off this concert, and he still had to put on the concert to pay off the debt that he had with other people.
Right.
It's like, and then they have actual footage of the people, the concert goers, like coming into the site, realizing what it actually is, which is like a bunch of tents,
right?
And like those kind of. Almost like relief tents that you get after like a disaster.
I think they were actual disaster. Like, they were actually FEMA tents that they got for surplus.
And so the people are just like horrified by this. And then of course, like it just gets worse from there. You know, what I mean? They show them what they promise them so much, though. That's the thing.
Right.
Like, they promise them luxurious meals. You know, you're gonna have these. You know, your own private cook and stuff like that. So for them to get like these, you know,
Cheese sandwich.
Cheese sandwich, yeah, was the picture that eventually went viral. Is just hilarious, I find.
Yeah, there were two fascinating chapters for me. One is when the social media company that's promoting it sort of refuses to do any more promotion, and within an hour, they've been fired and have been replaced by a new promotions company.
Yeah, but you and I were talking about how it was kind of Trump-esque, this guy, Billy McFarland.
Yeah.
But they actually kind of are cut from the same cloth, it seems. It's like people who are not going to be... They're yes men, the people that are not going to, like, you know, Billy McFarland always harped on, like, I want solutions.
Right.
And it's like, bro, we're telling you the truth, which is that it cannot be done. And then he just, like, gets rid of them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And there is some weird similarity in the narcissism they both have.
Right. And also never learning their lesson either, because one of the other interesting things is, and the documentary doesn't go into it too much, which I found bizarre, is that, you know, as he was out on bail to awaiting trial, he's getting the next scam going, which is this new, like, VIP access thing where he's selling tickets to the things that
you couldn't possibly
get tickets to. Yeah.
The Golden Globes or whatever. It's like all this stuff that you need a personal invite to. And prior to the Fyre Festival, he had this luxurious credit card business that totally went under as well. It was like, you know, one of those black, heavy, kind of luxurious looking credit cards that is allegedly supposed to get you into these kind of, you know, like these, whatever,
like VIP events or whatever. And like, yeah, there was,
and
like,
of course, that bombed because it's like, you know, my generation doesn't have that kind of money to spend on that kind of stuff and whatever.
My generation doesn't either. But
And then you look at this guy's history and it's like, he's never, this is what he's done his whole life. Just had loads of money and then just done irresponsible things with it.
People may be thinking, why two documentaries? And it's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Because the Netflix one, which is directed by Chris Smith, who's a really good, he did American Movie. Which,
no way, really?
Yeah, it's the same director.
That's crazy.
Yeah, and American movies are
one
really,
of my favorite documentaries ever.
Absolutely. I was just rewatching it recently, actually, for a project I'm working on. But so that one, it is with the, it was co-produced by Jerry Media, which is the production company that made the splashy model-filled videos that promoted Firefest. So that probably explains why they have so much behind-the-scenes footage.
Right.
The Hulu documentary, Fyre Fraud, actually has interviews with Billy McFarland. And it is alleged that they paid for that interview. So you have... You know, depending on how you feel about fraudsters making money off being fraudsters.
Well, it's kind of scummy, I think.
It's kind of scummy,
Even if he is kind of denigrating the whole thing, it's still kind of scummy.
Yeah.
It's like the Wolf of Wall Street kind of thing. It's like you're going to give
good example.
More money to a guy who, like, clearly was irresponsible with his money.
Yeah, absolutely. It's
and they paid
shady
him, what,
too.
Like $150,000 or something? It was not... Like chump change.
The Guardian article said that Chris Smith said that Billy McFarland told him that the documentarians for Hulu with the Hulu doc paid him $250,000, but because you're probably not going to take Billy McFarland's word for it, it's estimated that it was like something in the realm of $100,000. But still, this guy is in jail for massive fraud.
Yeah,
and he's still making money off. Fraud. Meanwhile, it's unlikely. There's a class action lawsuit that ruled that he has to pay out $5 million to all the people who took part in the suit. And those people are probably never going to see their money.
Well, that's the thing that really struck me about this documentary. It's like a lot of, the rich kind of people that we're talking about lost their money. People who are, you know, maybe young and successful and whatever. But really, who like really lost were the average kind of people.
Oh yeah, the workers in the Bahamas. Yeah,
of workers,
absolutely,
who worked to build these like sets, these whatever, the campsites,
the stage.
They served all these people drinks. They worked
seriously,
did backbreaking labor, and they got nothing because of this guy. I heard there's now some kind of GoFundMe for these people to like get them paid.
Yeah,
but that's what really struck me about all of this is that the lower class people were the ones that were the victims.
Yeah, that's very true. Yeah. There's almost more material here for further documentaries just to explore the different facets. But
it is a fascinating story. I would be very interested in seeing the Hulu documentary.
So would I. And if anyone,
even if it does, even if I did just,
you just called the people who made it scum. But yeah,
oh, I'm way above them now. Please show me where I can see this.
Show me your work.
Yeah.
Also hard at work is the members of the British Board of Film Classification. They have recently announced changes so that any film that shows scenes of sexual violence, including rape, get a automatic 15A rating, which is kind of the equivalent of the 14A rating here in Ontario. One of the examples was the Keira Knightley movie The Duchess, which strongly implies that the lead character is raped at one point. It was rated 12A when it came out, but now it would be 15A. I wonder, this is one of those things that, you know, it sounds like an interesting idea and a positive direction, but I wonder if it's, and maybe you can tell me how you feel, but it almost sounds like the push to trying to make all movies that have smoking in it rated R, that's been a thing.
Right.
And at least in Ontario, there's one group that's sort of pushing that if there's smoking in the movie, that it should have a higher rating, and thus it discourages kids to smoke because they don't see cool movie stars smoking. And
well, anything that prevents people from seeing The Duchess is not something that I want to be a part of. So no, I'm kidding. I haven't even seen that movie.
I almost believed you.
But it's like, what it comes down to is context for me. I can't name any movies. I don't even know if I can name one movie that has a rape scene that isn't like 18A or above 14A. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard for me to like see where the examples are, aside from The Duchess, which apparently has one.
But well, I guess it's a matter of explicity, right? Mm-hmm. That, you know, you could imply that someone was raped and maybe still get the increased rating. Whereas, you know, something like Irreversible or L, you know, that would, which is kind of what those movies are about,
mm-hmm.
is one thing. But I, the content part of this is what I find interesting, because something like Eighth Grade, mm-hmm. which is a very in-your-face movie about, you know, youth and being young and what it's like to grow up as a young person entering puberty now, it's rated R.
Is
even
it?
Though the main character is 13 years old, and there's a like a genuine feeling about like that this is what it's like to experience youth right now, and it's all because, you know, we don't want to deal frankly with certain subject matter. And I'm even something like The King's Speech too, which was rated R because of one scene where the king uses the F word.
Yeah, that's absurd. But I thought the people that made these ratings took it on a case-by-case basis as well.
No,
they were supposed to watch it and determine for themselves. So it wasn't an automatic kind of their smoking's there, therefore it automatically gets an R.
Well, you would think so.
Right.
But, you know, there very famously there's the, at least in sort of the motion picture, the U.S. Motion Picture Film Ratings Board, you get away with one F word in a PG-13 movie. So you have to be like strategic in where you put your F word if you want to use an F word. So it just...
But then you get the case of the people that should probably see Eighth Grade the most, which are those... That age of people cannot see it now.
Or, like, you know, not without their parents or...
Yeah, so the effect is kind of lost in a way.
So it's, you know, that's right.
So, I don't know.
I don't expect us to have solutions, Lala, but it's interesting to just...
Yeah.
I feel like this is like a... It's a good idea that... is not, will not play out practically. Like, yeah, we should be encouraging kids to not start smoking, of course. But, you know, when you're filming a scene and it's, you know, World War II and you're in a room with a bunch of, or forget even with the generals, just like on the front lines in the trenches where there was nothing to do but light up a cigarette. It seems silly to just use that as a baseline. And I think it's the same thing with sexual violence. Yeah, if you're using sexual violence as like a way to
coerce
being exploitative or something like that, I mean, that's one thing. But if it's, you know, if it's supposed to be sort of informational or it's supposed to inform like the script, again, it's a case by case basis kind of thing. And it's just. Anyway, that's a heavy topic. What might not be as heavy is the career trajectory of M. Night Shyamalan. And we're going to tee up Glass by just talking a bit about his career, because it's hard to think of people who've like sort of swung more wildly from extremes. Yeah. Like, he was someone who, after Sixth Sense, could do no wrong. Like, he was like, this guy's like an exciting new voice and he's going to go places. And
there was one magazine that actually had a picture of him and it said the next Spielberg with a question mark.
Right. I mean, go back far enough in the Ontarian archives and you'll see some superlatives that I made about M. Night Shyamalan. But
you were not a fan.
No, that I was excited.
Oh, okay.
And this was after Signs too. So, right. I mean, even so, things were like teetering at that point. But yeah, he goes from that to just like everybody completely writing him off, just to go from dud to dud to dud to dud, and then he makes this comeback.
Where did it start, though? Because I feel like it was around The Village when
he went off.
He was going off, yeah. I think it was because he just like ran out of ideas, maybe.
The Village, you know what? Village is like 7/8 of a good movie.
Yeah, it's even his like trajectory has a trajectory. It's right. Like there was degrees of badness to the movies until, and then Lady in the Water was just like straight up bad, and then.
Well, the problem with The Village is you see the twist coming. You know that the twist is coming. You know what the twist is, and it kind of haunts, pun intended, the whole movie till it gets to that point. And then of course, when you find out the twist. Who is standing there when you're learning the twist? It is M. Night Shyamalan himself and one of his obligatory cameos. And so I think that ticked a lot of people off. I think looking backwards, a lot of people are probably a bit more fond of The Village now, looking back at it, than they were at the time.
It's a nice score, too.
It's a nice score. Oh, the score is fantastic. But the then he goes with Lady in the Water, and it's like this thing that filmmakers sometimes do. It's like, y'all critics don't get me. You're ticking me off. So I'm gonna mock you so hard. It's like when you get Mayor Ebert in Godzilla.
Yeah,
it's just this sort of fit of pique. And of course, you come out of Lady in the Water. Everybody hates that. And then you go right into The Happening, which I think was an interesting idea. But you don't hire Mark Wahlberg to play the science teacher.
Yeah, fine. I actually didn't think it was that bad.
I don't think it's that bad either. I think it's that bad when you have Mark Wahlberg being the guy giving you the science. It's like Gerard Butler saving the world from climate change and Geostorm.
Yeah, sure. Well, I'll take your word for that. I never actually saw that. Yeah, did he go into Avatar right after that? Right after
The Happening? Yes, yes, Airbender was after that.
Right, okay.
It was Airbender, and then it was After Earth.
Well, M. Night Shyamalan is a guy that I have always respected, honestly. Like, he is a classic grinder, you know what I mean? He is a Spielberg or Scorsese that started with, like, no connections and just kind of got to where he is just by raw talent. Like, he came to international prominence with The Sixth Sense, but he had two really bad independent films before that. And this is one of the lessons that he always says that actually stuck with me for a long time, which is, you know, go straight to The Sixth Sense. Do not start with something cheap that you're not that passionate about, but you think might advance your career a little bit, just go straight for what you're actually passionate about. So, you know, after those two films, he obviously kind of had a moment of introspection or something where he was like, I need to do something big and bold. And by his own admission, he was like, I'm going to sell a script for $1 million. And I don't know what it is, but I'm going to sell a script for $1 million. And that became 10 drafts later, became The Sixth Sense.
100 G's a draft.
Yeah. And I just remember that movie became like a cultural phenomenon. If we
can
just talk about The Sixth Sense for like a minute. It's, I mean, I See Dead People, that was like everywhere. It was, and I remember The Phantom Menace actually came out that year, I think, as well.
It was that same summer.
And so there was these two parallel kind of phenomenons happening at the same time. One was obviously like, you know, kind of decades in the making, but I was witnessing both of these. I think I was like probably 7 or 8 in 1999. But I was witnessing both of them like kind of happening simultaneously. And it was very interesting, the Sixth Sense. And it's just a beautiful film too. Like it's just a very, it's a screenplay that I have studied like as a writer, like for many years. Like there's a lot going on. You know, there's the kind of redemptive story of Bruce Willis, you know what I mean? He gets shot by one of his clients and he's, his, there's this great motivation right from the get-go of him trying to like work with Haley Joel Osment to kind of redeem himself from that client that he kind of failed. And then there's kind of the more terrifying story of Haley Joel Osment.
There's, I mean, there's a lot to talk about with like the year 1999.
That was a great,
because that's the year of The Matrix, that's the year of American Beauty, that's the year of Three Kings,
being John Malkovich.
So it's but you're right about The Sixth Sense, and it is, I haven't revisited it for a while, so I might try and do that, but it is funny having watched Shyamalan fall so far down and to come back and are we on the, you know, the cliff again?
But there is something to say for that kind of that eagerness, I think, that happens in filmmakers sometimes early in their career. That kind of, you know, screw it, I'm just going to go with my gut kind of balls to the wall kind of big kind of supernatural horror movie thing. And so I think he put everything he had into that. He was probably really like determined to kind of make it after those two failures. And then after that, after it's like, you know, you've created such a huge phenomenon. It's like, and it's like he fell off, but he didn't fall off immediately. It's like Unbreakable and Signs were like both really good, man. It's like he didn't start to fall off until like after that. So there's this weird period where he was actually like on a roll. Like he was actually on a serious roll.
Well, we'll see if he's back on a serious roll, because we're going to review Glass next. And stay tuned. We'll be back after the musical break. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
What's upsetting you, Patricia?
What if he can't do these extraordinary things? What if he is just unwell? Like you?
Everything extraordinary can be explained away, and yet it is true. I think deep down you know this. Everything we will see and do will have a basis in science. But It will have limits. This is the real world, not a cartoon. And yet some of us don't die from bullets. Some of us can still bend steel. That is not a fantasy.
And that was a clip from Glass. It is the new film from M. Night Shyamalan. And it stars James McAvoy, Bruce Willis, Samuel L. Jackson, Anya Taylor-Joy, and Sarah Paulson. So
this is, of course, the Hugh Glass biopic that we've been waiting for.
Starring Samuel L. Jackson as Mr. Glass. Yeah. So it's a sequel of sorts to the 2000 movie Unbreakable, which starred Bruce Willis and Samuel L. Jackson, and also a sequel to the 2016 movie Split, starring James McAvoy and Anya Taylor-Joy. It is the quote-unquote completion to the quote-unquote planned, quote-unquote trilogy of Shyamalan. I think there's a lot of presumptions here about how much this was planned. I think Shyamalan smartly seized on an opportunity to take two movies of his that are very fondly thought of and very popular and manage to combine them. And I think for a good 40 minutes there, it was working okay.
Really? You would give it that much credit?
The first 40 minutes. The first 40 minutes, I think, are solid.
Yeah, I got to dig deep here because I don't actually remember like most of it because I was just...
you were aghast.
I was aghast. That's a much better way of putting it, actually. I was aghast.
But I did like what Bruce Willis's, the glimpse of what Bruce Willis's life has looked like as sort of like a vigilante superhero, and it's since Unbreakable, and his relationship with his son, how his son's like the guy behind the screen.
Yeah, and he's like running, whatever home security operation now, yeah. Whatever. Yeah, I guess that was kind of interesting, but then it's like, do one thing right. Mm. It's like the fact that you had to throw in like three of your movies, like a Marvel like trilogy, and kind of blend them all together in this like really incoherent thing.
Yeah.
Just like took it down so much. Mm. And the movie's called Glass, and it's like he's in it for like 10 minutes. He's like not even in it at
yeah.
all. It's like he... And even when he is in it, is he really propelling the plot? Not really, yeah. I would say.
It's interesting. I mean, that's probably the most interesting part of this, because when it says Glass, it's called Glass, but Mr. Glass is almost like an afterthought through much of it.
And there's a scene at the end, okay, where like Mr. Glass comes out,
yeah,
and he's like all done up.
Yeah, he looks like Purple Rain.
Yeah. But no, I don't know if you saw this. He's also got like a brooch on that said MG.
That's right.
And it's like, I'm not even kidding. At that point, I knew it was done. I was like, come on. It was like MG, Mr. Glass, and it had like little diamonds on it. I was like, give me a break, man.
He's been waiting 20 years to wear that
what?
Outfit.
I know. He's been like, yeah. Straightening that brooch in the mirror.
It's funny because I never thought I would see a movie where Bruce Willis was the one who was like working and Samuel L. Jackson is the one who's kind of passive and seems like sort of not fairly invested in what's going on. Like, because Bruce Willis has seemed like he's given up for a long time now.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, in all his direct-to-video stuff, but even in stuff like Death Wish, which is actually like a studio-supported big release movie, he looks like... this is what my life is. Okay. In this, he actually seemed engaged, which was very refreshing. And Samuel L. Jackson seemed the one who wasn't really that.
Engaged, yeah.
Which is kind of bizarre because in Samuel L. Jackson's other... And maybe it's a feedback loop. In Samuel L. Jackson's other life, as the guy who ties the Marvel universe together, I mean, maybe this was too much. I don't know. Like, just like, here I am in another superhero movie as a different guy.
But
I don't know.
there's just like no action at all for the first like hour, man. Like, it's so boring. And they're all in like, they all get like thrown in this asylum together. And Sarah Paulson just like interrogates them endlessly for like what seems like 10 hours.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh man, are we going to like actually get somewhere?
Yeah.
And then there's like kind of a bizarre twist with her as well at the end.
Well, there's a couple of twists.
So absurd.
Yeah, there's a couple of twists that I'm just not fond of the other twist either.
Yeah, and so eventually it becomes like Bruce Willis, like Mr. Glass, and
the Beast,
James McAvoy from Split. Kind of team up and they're wreaking havoc and it's up to Bruce Willis to kind of like stop them.
Yeah.
And then there's the moment where he dons the like raincoat that is supposed to be iconic of him.
The iconic
like
poncho.
It's supposed to be, Superman throwing on his cape. And it's like, it's a poncho, man. This is absurd. This looks ridiculous.
I like that he's still going around wearing the poncho.
And it's like clearly M. Night Shyamalan was like, yeah, I've got some of my own like superheroes here. And it's like, no, dude, your guy is wearing a brooch with his name on it. Your other guy is wearing a poncho. It's like, no, this is just, it seems like, I don't know. He's just hopping on what is like trendy now. Like even with The Visit too, it was like, oh, the found footage thing is like big. I got to do my found footage movie. Now it's like, cross-referencing your own universe and whatever is big, so now I got to do my own thing. And it's like, dude, this was never what you were good at.
Right.
And now David Ayer, I think, is like facing the same problem. He's kind of the same, like, you know, do what's hot and in right now. Mm. He did his own like found footage thing, and they were good found footage movies, both of them. But it's just kind of, I think it says a lot about their character that they're doing this kind of stuff now.
I think the problem is that you're talking about three movies with three very different characters. Like Unbreakable is a thriller.
Yeah.
Split is kind of a more traditional horror movie. And then this is trying to be sort of a low budget superhero kind of movie. But I think he self-funded it himself. Like he self-funded Split and The Visit too. So, I mean, that is to his credit.
It's like, you should have to prove yourself at this point, man.
Right.
Like, you're not getting my money.
Well, that's what What's-His-Face is doing too with
Oaks.
But
The Visit couldn't have cost, like, a lot.
No, but, I mean, I think this film, perhaps the vision he was trying to bring could have been realized with a bigger budget. Because he does have to...
And a better script.
And a better script, because I think one of the things that's problematic, too, is that it's just these three.
Yeah.
That we've already met before, and if you wanted to open up the world and make it bigger, then there should have been like maybe a new person to come in that sort of ties these three or brings these three together for different reasons. Or you know, you have two bad guys already, and you know, the Beast and in Mr. Glass, maybe you know, David, the Bruce Willis character, needs a sidekick or something.
Because James McAvoy clearly like steals the show. I think
he's great.
Character clearly has the most energy, the most personality.
Yeah.
He is the funnest to watch.
Characters.
Yeah, when he is on screen, it's like that's what makes it. But then it's like it goes back to like
there's some
sour-faced Bruce Willis and like the comatose, you know, Mr. Glass, and it's like,
and there's some great stuff with Anya Taylor-Joy too, as she's the one who survives Split, and you know, is trying to reconcile that and trying to understand, you know, why she was let go and her significance, and she's trying to reach Kevin. She's trying to save Kevin, who's the main prime personality in the what they call the Horde, which is led by the Beast, and she's trying to reach him, and there was a lot of good stuff there, which I don't know. You know, I don't want to rethink what Shyamalan was thinking or try to, you know, what he's trying to get to the bottom of, but it almost seems like he could have made a Split sequel, and then he shoves this Unbreakable stuff on it too, so that he could, you know,
do his gimmick,
right. Rather than maybe using that to launch maybe a new story. Like, if he wants to keep telling stories in this universe, that's fine. But, you know, maybe you could have Mr. Glass in it. Maybe you can bring in David
Maybe
Dunn.
You can have Mr. Glass do more, too.
Like, maybe you
can.
Yeah, you name like the movie Glass.
He derails a train in the first one. Like, well, come on. Have something.
Well, it's implied he did magnitude. More than that.
Yeah, exactly.
Which, I mean, and I saw this mentioned online that the movie seems oddly forgiving of, is that it's implied at the end of Unbreakable that Mr. Glass had been basically, I mean, it was before 9/11, so people didn't really fully appreciate the term, but Mr. Glass was basically a terrorist.
Yes.
Committing terrorist acts to try and find extraordinary people that he could then, you know, shepherd into, you know, superhero status.
And that's what he says at one point in the film. It's like, I find superheroes or whatever. It's
maybe. How do you find them, Mr. Glass?
Yeah. The expense of like many other people, like,
right?
What was it about? Like, did M. Night Shyamalan just like give up, or did like horror movies just like change? You know what I mean? Because the found footage thing was popular at one point. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? When I look at the movies that he was making in the early 2000s, late 90s, they are kind of the time before mm-hmm. these. I don't know, maybe mile a minute kind of jump scare movies came out. So I don't know. Right. Was he just unable to keep up with the times, or did he just kind of run out of
content? It's interesting.
Content?
It's interesting because, you know, thinking about that, like the turn of the century, like what were the popular horror movies? There were all these like postmodern things, these all winky, self-referential kind of things. And he was someone who was doing straight up like thrillers. And, you know, around that time, it kind of takes a turn, at least in the popular media, it takes a turn to the torture porn stuff. So you get Saw and you get Hostel, and maybe he didn't want to go there. I think this plays a part of it too. Maybe he bought into his own hype where people were comparing him to Spielberg and Hitchcock. And he's I am Spielberg and Hitchcock now. Spielberg, Hitchcock, Shyamalan, why not? And so and I feel like Glass is maybe sort of tipping that way, where he was down so far, he could make The Visit, he could make Split, and people are like, holy crap, M. Night Shyamalan can make good films.
Yeah, he's back.
He's back. And then he goes into Glass, and of course he has this extended cameo in it where he plays the super, who was the super of the building of Kevin Crumb's psychologist in Split, but it's also implied that he was also encountered Bruce Willis's character in Unbreakable, and that this was the same character. And I'm just like, no. As soon as he comes up on screen, I'm like, Shyamalan, get out of here. Get out of here. I don't want to see your face. Just go. This is where you start to get into believing your own hype. It's you know.
Yeah, it's just like tone deaf. There, he didn't know what he wanted to do with it, and it's like one of the funniest things I think is how Bruce Willis is actually contained in this, which is having these nozzles of water pointed in his direction. And it's like, come on, is this like 1930s Batman? Like,
well,
because
yeah.
his weakness is water, but it's like, okay, you're behind a steel door, man. It's like,
but I do actually enjoy that stuff in it. That it's very basic.
They tried to make it character specific or something,
right? It's very basic stuff. You know, it's not like, you know, something like Doctor Strange where it's magical, mystical, and complicated, or, you know, something like Aquaman, you know, with like mysticism and, you know, superpowers under the sea and all that. It's just very basic. David Dunn is a super strong guy, and his one weakness is water. Mr. Glass is a super smart guy, but his bones are brittle and they break easily.
That conflict was so good. He made it so good and Unbreakable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a simplicity to it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Which is, I mean, it goes back to that clip where Mr. Glass says, you know, there are limits. You know, we're not in a cartoon. This is real life. Mm-hmm. But which is why I think the film would have benefited by having new characters, different characters, where he could have expanded into this. with different powers and just to expand, like, if you're going to expand the universe, expand the universe. The problem is that I think this movie makes the universe smaller, especially when we get to the twist, when we find out there's a connection between two characters that you wouldn't think have a connection. But when you have a twist like that, it just makes the universe smaller. And it's an independent movie. He made it for like $20 million. So it doesn't need the help to feel small. It already feels pretty small. Yeah. So why not just try and open it up a bit more? Because then you can also open it up to, and I hesitate to say this, but future entries in the franchise if you have more characters going
on. Yeah, I don't know, man.
Instead of like sealing the drum, which is what I feel like he does at the end of this. He's like, well, I've said everything I needed to say, which may be for the best, but
I think about all of the good movies he could have made with that $20 million, man, like just an original new movie. And it just makes me sad.
Yeah. It makes me sad that,
because I thought he was back, man, like after the visit. I really did. I was like, oh, it's kind of goofy. It's kind of gimmicky what he's doing at the end of the visit, introducing David Dunn again.
That was at the end of Split.
Split.
Yeah.
What did I say?
You said the visit.
Okay, sorry. Split. Yeah. But I was like, no, he got the message. He took his like hiatus, reevaluated things, and now he's back. Mm-hmm. And it's like, Glass, really?
And he teamed up with Blumhouse too, which is like if you're going to team up with someone in the horror business,
yeah,
you know, Jason Blum is hard to get much better than that.
He was probably going off the success of Split, thinking that it was like just going to be.
It's disappointing, is what it is.
It is, yeah, yeah.
It's just it's not just disappointing as someone who likes comic books. I you know, that was my thing growing up. I like comic books. I still have comic books. I don't read them as much as I used to, but I mean, I still have them. And I mean, it feels like you don't want to parlay this as the, like, are we at like the end of the comic book, you know, movie boom, or is it like, are we petering out? Is it the end of the genre? Because I think that's very hard to say. But I mean, there are two types of comic book movies now. The ones that are able to change it up enough to sort of seem different and seem original and are still able to be crowd pleasers, and the ones that kind of get anchored by the mythology and by the demands and are, you know, maybe trying too hard to copy what other people are trying to do. Some of those movies are able to break the mold. Others aren't able to break the mold. And
some of them are unbreakable.
But I feel like this could have been something like Chronicle, which is a comic, again, another comic movie made on the cheap that manages to play with all the same tropes and archetypes and still be able to tell the story in a new and different and exciting way, and it feel sort of grounded and real.
And then when they give him money and they're like, here, you can actually make one.
It's a similar story, yeah, because, yeah, Josh Trank, when made that awful Fantastic Four.
And then on top of that, he blamed the studio, which was like double whammy.
Well, I mean, if nothing else, going back to Shyamalan, maybe this gets it out of his system. And, you know, because he has talked about over the years about trying to get that follow-up to Unbreakable. And now maybe it's out of his system. And now maybe we can go back to
something new.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just lazy. You know what I mean? Because, like, the Unbreakable is such a clever script. The Sixth Sense is such a clever script. You know what I mean? Like, when you think about how many clever things that you couldn't notice the first time around. For him to just slap this together like this, just
yeah, it does feel kind of slapped together. And there are callbacks in this to Unbreakable. And there's one scene where he shows Unbreakable, where after David saves the family, and he's at breakfast the next morning with his wife and his son, and he gently passes the newspaper to his son to show the detailing what happened the night before, and there were tears in his son's eye because his father, you know, every son sees his father as a superhero, and there's a genuine emotion to that, plus the whole thing about, you know, David realizing his thing. And that's the other thing to this too, is that Unbreakable is a tidy little arc for the David character.
Yeah.
He realizes his purpose and he pursues his purpose.
Realizes what his
kryptonite
is as well.
Right. But I mean, that's a closed story. Like, it was nice to see him again at the end of Split, because you can go, oh, yeah, I get that.
Yeah.
But his story was kind of concluded in Unbreakable. So it's, anyway, disappointing all around.
Yeah. And then they try to bring that kind of son, father-son kind of dynamic back into Glass, and it just doesn't work at all. There's like no chemistry between them. And then he is thrown into an asylum room for the next hour, and the son is kind of swept under the rug.
Yeah, there's not a great arc for Spencer Treat Clark, which is sad because I don't think he gets a lot of work anymore.
It's the same like son from Unbreakable, isn't
it? No,
like, it's the same actor. Yeah.
20 years later. Yeah.
So that's cool.
Well, at least we're ending on a positive note.
Yeah.
That's it for our show this week. We hope you like it. We're glad we're back, by the way. We're doing original episodes again.
We're glass, we're back. Sorry, I'm done.
If you like puns like that, go to our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. You can listen to past episodes there. You can find us on social media, End Credits Radio Show on Facebook, End Credits Radio on Twitter. And Vince, if you want to serve up more delightful puns like that, where can people find you on the internet?
Oh, why not go to my Twitter page, at vmasson5.
All right. And I'll be back here tomorrow on CFRU for News and Politics and Open Sources Guelph with Scotty Hertz. And you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or go to my political site, guelphpolitico.ca. And stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU, 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. And we'll be back next Wednesday at 2 p.m. for more end credits. And we will see you then.